Welcome to Hazel's Story, an epic saga podcast. We're here to dive deep into the panels and pages of Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples' comic book masterpiece, unpacking the amazing characters, themes, and weirdness in this grand space opera. I'm Alan.
And my name's Abu.
And I don't know about you, Abu, but I cannot wait to dig into chapters 19, 20, and 21 on this episode, the first three chapters of Volume 4.
Yeah.
I think I've said this before, but Volume 4 might just be my favorite part of this story so far. Every time I come back and do a reread, I can't wait to get to these chapters. It's just, I don't even know. I don't want to spoil anything, so we'll just get into it.
Yeah. That's so interesting you say that. I remember you saying this was your favorite part of the story, because for me, this is maybe like lower on the parts of Saga that I like the best, because it's so sad. It's so tragic. It's so horrible. It's like watching a train wreck happen. Oh. We'll get into it today, of course, but it is a very stressful set of chapters.
This is true. Maybe I'm a bigger fan of watching things fall apart than you are. We haven't really talked about our various tastes in culture, literature, and stories, but I think I am usually more of a sucker for a well-told, deeply intense, and potentially sad narrative. That's the, I may or may not have been an emo kid in the 2000s.
Yeah, and, I was gonna say.
That lines up. It checks out, folks. It checks out.
Yeah. Well, I'll let you psychoanalyze that in therapy, but I wonder what that says about you. I am excited to dive into these chapters, though. There's some amazing writing from Brian, and of course, there is some incredible artwork from Fiona, all of which we're going to dive into today. But before we jump in, a quick warning. This episode will be spoiler-free up to the chapters we've read today. So as long as you have read the first 21 chapters of Saga, you are okay to continue listening. We will not be discussing any plot that takes place in future chapters. So if this is your first time reading Saga, we hope to enhance your experience with this discussion. And if you're a returning reader or a longtime fan, well, hopefully you'll get something out of our deep dive today as well.
And we always love to hear from you, our listeners. We haven't gotten quite as many responses lately as we have been before, perhaps due to our somewhat sporadic release schedule, which we'll get into later. But we still love to hear from you. We have our email address, hazelsstorypodcast@gmail.com. Hit us up with any thoughts or episode ideas. And we have an announcement at the end of this episode where we are, in fact, going to have our first guest on the show. And we want to know if there's guests you'd like to have us talk to about Saga, people you know from the world of comics or culture or the internet or whatever. So send us an email, hazelsstorypodcast@gmail.com. There's two S's in a row there. Can't wait to hear from you.
I'm convinced that there are actually hundreds of emails being sent to hazelsstorypodcast@gmail.com with one S. It's the two S that's slipping people up.
Totally could be. So we're going to dive into these chapters with, as always, a brief summary. Then we'll get into our key takeaways and finally wrap up with our favorite panels and quotes. So, Abu, why don't you take it away? Let's get into it.
Yes, let's do it. Today's reading starts off with chapter 19. And hold on to something steady, folks, because this chapter opens with a full page shot of robot vagina in the middle of giving birth. And the only thing I want to say here is that I'm never having kids. Let's move on to chapter 20.
It is right up in there in a way that I will say, even having been present at the birth of my daughter, that's not a perspective I was ever privy to.
Yeah.
It is truly the miracle of life. Miracle. Miracle.
Miracle of life indeed. Well, at this moment, Princess Robot has given birth to a healthy young robot boy who is not named Prince Robot the Fourth, Alan, okay? Mm-hmm. Because Robot the Fourth is totally still alive.
Totally still alive.
At least that's what the princess believes.
But missing, that's the important part here, is that nobody has seen or heard from Prince Robot the Fourth in a minute.
That's right. I also want to shout out, I know we're big fans of Alligator Butler. I think we should also shout out Alligator Nurse here.
Yes.
She just barely kept her job. And I'm grateful for that.
There's a whole alligator servant class that we're learning more and more about. And yeah. I'm totally here for it. And I want to learn more about it. I want the spinoff show, like the Downton Abbey version of the Robot Kingdom, ooh, where we spend a whole bunch of time like in the servants area, figuring out the lives of these alligator serving class and like, how they live their lives. Brian and Fiona, hit us up. We're here to help you develop this amazing spinoff series.
100%. Hazelstorypodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget the two S's. Now the scene continues and Hazel's narration comes in, giving us a brief history of the Robot Kingdom and their alliance with Landfall in this war against Wreath. Kind of a refresher in case it's been a while since you've picked up Saga. We then cut back to the palace where we meet a lowly janitor named Dango, who is ordered by the aforementioned alligator nurse to clean up the mess in the birthing room. And his face flashes to an angry skull. The TV on his face shows this angry skull, which is obviously some heavy, heavy foreshadowing for what's to come in the next two chapters.
Yes, totally. And then we immediately cut to a totally different environment. This entire set of chapters is just one after the other, like going between these different worlds that have very, very different environments. Like the Robot Kingdom is full of kings and royalty and majesty. And then we cut to Hazel jumping around in a bouncy castle in what seems like a nice, like contemporary suburban town. Marco has dyed his hair blonde and is wearing bandages on his face as a kind of disguise of some sort, which we find out makes sense because everyone just assumes he's a veteran of the war, which is like, oh, right, there's this terrible, brutal war. So there's going to be like disfigured people all over the place. Not a terrible disguise. A young mother approaches him on the playground and fumbles through some bad blue. She's trying to speak to him in blue. Marco explains that he can understand her because of the translation pendants. And she's getting a little flirty. Marco is a little awkward about it.
Yeah.
And then she hands him her business card, pointing out that his daughter is a little bit full of energy, and maybe Hazel wants to come to the dance studio to, quote, kill an hour, channel some of that excess energy, which 100%, that makes sense. I didn't even get this, but you wrote into the script that she's talking about Hazel's high energy as a toddler, but that, like, it's an allusion to sex, that, like, channel some of that excess energy could be, like, getting it on between the two of them. There's a double entendre there that I totally missed, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, this... From the jump, she clearly wants to, like, get with Marco, and she's not subtle about it.
For sure. There's a lot of not-so-subtle hints at just, like, sex and cheating. I mean, one of the first things Marco says to this woman is, well, I'm cheating, when he's trying to awkwardly talk about his translator ring. So, I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but the way she kind of trails off on... maybe burn some of that excess energy as she's like inviting him to her dance studio. Felt very sexual and flirty to me. So after that scene in the park, we then cut to Alana, who is at work at the circuit, where in the scene she's working on, she has to make out with one of her coworkers. And once again, speaking of like heavy-handed allusions to cheating and sex and relationships, here is a full-page spread of Alana locking lips with another man. That for us as the reader is painful to see because we are cheering so much for Marco and Alana as our central couple in this story. Now, one of the viewers doesn't like the kiss as much as we do, apparently, because he starts heckling the performers and Alana claps back in classic Alana fashion. This lands her in hot water with the stage manager, who fires her on the spot until Yuma... Remember Yuma? Intervenes. Yuma, of course, is Heist's ex and the connection to the circuit that he mentioned a few chapters ago. It also turns out that Heist and Yuma put in a good word for Alana and Marco, and that's probably how Alana landed this job. So for the moment, thanks to Yuma, Alana's job is safe, but it's obvious that she is not having the best time at work. She is not fitting in at the circuit as well as she would have wanted. And work stress is just another thing to add to the list of pressures that Marco and Alana are currently dealing with.
I do like that we get this very direct example of how the open circuit works. I feel like we'd gotten little hints at it before then that, like, you put on this helmet and then, like, you get to see the participants. But I didn't understand until we got to this chapter that, like, you're not just watching. You literally are, like, in a sort of metaverse audience where you can actually like shout at the performers like they're on a stage, which honestly, this is the most compelling case for the metaverse I've seen thus far. Like if this is actually how Meta wants to create their metaverse where I can like put on a VR helmet and be like watching live performances that are photorealistic, I'd be down for that. I don't know that everybody should have the ability to shout at the performers though. Like all good community experiences on the internet, you got to have some moderation. And Alana tries to moderate the troll basically, right? And she gets in trouble for it.
Right. Yeah, it's extremely on brand for Alana to do so. And in fact, I think many of us in that situation would react in that way, but it obviously gets her in trouble.
Whomst among us has not read a comment or a review or something like that and been like, sir, and it's usually a sir, what the fuck are you talking about?
For real.
So
we've all been there.
After Alana has had to put up with that, she returns to the rocket ship tree where she comes in and Clara, her mother-in-law, informs her that the hot water repair witch requires another 900 credits for a new part for the rocket ship tree, which classic sitcom, like come home from a long day at work just to find out some more bad news at home. It's delightful.
Yep.
When Alana asks about Hazel, she learned that her daughter is already asleep because Marco took her out to play. This is clearly a point of tension between the couple and their dynamic, one of the many arguments they're having lately as they're trying to settle into domestic life. The couple are clearly burnt out and super on edge, but all of this tension is deflated when sleepy Hazel toddles into the room and asking for a skish, which in a sign of how little Alana has been around, Alana doesn't know what that means, and Marco has to tell her that skish means squish, which is a big family hug that everybody participates in. And spoiler, this is my favorite panel of these chapters, and I'll talk more about it later, but it's just so amazingly rendered and also super, super sad. The chapter ends on the most ominous of ominous like narrations that we've gotten from Hazel that says, quote, "This is the story of how my parents split up," unquote.
Oh my gosh. Just the fact that you go from this family hug and you flip the page to a full page spread of this family holding each other tightly with that narration. Brian, Fiona, how dare you?
Totally. So that's the end of chapter 19. Chapter 19 started with the close-up of the robot birth, and then chapter 20 actually starts with robot group sex, basically. It starts with Prince Robot the Fourth being attended to by three of the staff of Sextillion, one of whom appears, I just noticed on this rereading, to have a beaver tail, which I'd never noticed. Anyway, Mama's son is apparently watching Prince Robot get services, and we find out from a convo she has with someone on her staff that Prince Robot has been hiding out on the Bordello planet for some time, which Mama's son thinks is because he's trying to avoid his responsibilities, including the fact that he's become a father, which is in a newspaper. I love that there's newspapers in this world for some reason. There's a newspaper article that the princeling has been born, and Mama Sun gets this amazing line where she says, quote, "That's probably why he's here. Nothing drives a man to new pussy faster than seeing a kid come out of the old one," which is like weird and fucked up, but also something I guess that like Bordello mistress would say.
Mm-hmm. Totally on brand. And actually, speaking of families and fatherhood, we then cut back to the rocket ship tree, where it is very, very early in the day. Marco is woken up by something that Isabel calls Hazel's breakfast screech. And Alan, between the two of us, you are the father here. I don't know if that's a real thing, but it sounds horrifying.
I just love that, like, as I'm reading through these panels, it's like every panel has her making this terrible sound, which I imagine is something like, which is like, I'm hungry. I don't have words yet, but I'm going to make you very clear to you that I am hungry.
Yeah. It's awful. So the screeching continues for several more panels as Isabel gives Marco some childcare instructions before she disappears because she's a ghost. She's only around at nighttime. And this is how we know that the sun is rising.
Mm-hmm.
I liked the panel where she sort of like gets sucked back into Hazel, reminding us that she embodies or she like is soul bonded to this little baby. I had forgotten that fact until we saw that panel.
No, it's wonderful. It also answers a question that I had of like, why is Marco so stressed out about all this childcare if he's got essentially a nanny? And it's like, oh, the nanny's only around at night. So during the other, you know, half of the day when the child is not sleeping, it's all him. I don't know where his mom is in all of this, but it seems like he's doing the majority of the parenting, which when a kid is this age is just full time, all the time, no breaks.
Yeah. Totally. And notably, Alana is not here. Presumably she left for work early because he's alone in bed right now.
Yep.
And he looks over at his jacket, notices the business card mm-hmm. that the woman in the park gave him yesterday. And the scene ends with him grabbing the business card and looking at it. So then we cut to Alana, who is at work, and we are thrown smack into the middle of another circuit scene where the co-stars appear to be in this like heated argument between each other about pay equity, but it turns out this is all actually like a scripted thing. It's all part of the show, which is fun as far as cute meta narratives go. Extremely on brand for Brian.
Well, it also makes me realize that like the open circuit is probably less close to like scripted Hollywood and closer to like the WWE or like influencer drama.
Yeah.
Because the characters are the performers, are the characters, are the performers, right? So like they're leaning into the fact that they're performers. It's acknowledged that they're performers. It's a lot, you know, with the costumes and stuff, it's like wrestling. And I just totally love that.
Yeah, that's a great point. Even in this previous scene where Alana clapped back at the heckler, mm-hmm. they tried to just like cover it, right? Like mm-hmm. throw a little improv in there and be like, oh no, she's lost her mind, zap her.
She's got the space madness.
Yeah. So you're totally spot on that. I'm sure these scenes are very loosely scripted and they lean very heavily into that. So after the scene is wrapped up, Alana is back in the cast locker room with Yuma, where she discovers that the secret to getting through the stress of these filming sessions and to being an actor, apparently, is to start using some drug called Fadeaway, which she learns that many of her fellow cast members use all the time and use even at work when they're on stage. And this leads to Yuma giving Alana some of this Fadeaway, which she takes a little bite out of and goes on an absolute acid trip in this beautiful set of panels and pages, which I'll talk a bit more about later because this was my favorite panel from today's reading.
It's so good.
After that, we cut back to what Marco is up to. Unfortunately, he did end up going to the dance studio. Hazel is at the studio with her dad and this woman. And things are not subtle at this point. This woman is really coming on to Marco. And as much as he's pushing back, he's definitely not pushing back enough to not end up dancing with her. Because that is exactly how this short little scene ends. Hazel dancing in the corner while Marco dances with this other woman that is not his wife. And it's seemingly after hours as well, because no one else is in the dance studio. They're all just there alone.
Yeah, it's a private lesson, Abu. Emphasis on the private. Yikes! Ruh-roh.
Yikes!
So we cut away from there, and we're back to the Robot Kingdom with a nice like wide shot on the Robot Kingdom. I don't think we've ever gotten one of those before. And it's literally looks like Cloud City from Star Wars, except with like medieval castles that are robot castles. I love it. It's one of those amazing Fiona wide shot scenes that I just totally love. Then we go inside the castle to see Princess Robot, who is singing to her newly born child. And Dango shows up unexpectedly, seemingly innocuously, because he's just carrying a mop. And it's like, yeah, a janitor with a mop. What could be wrong with that? Mm-hmm. But then we realize that he's actually murdered all of her guards. And he pulls the top of the mop off. And it's a sword, which is an amazing take on the old sword in a cane bit from like the 19th century.
Yeah.
Sword in a mop. Why not? So he then sort of brandishes this sword at Princess Robot. She says, don't hurt my baby. And he says, I would never hurt a child. I'm a father myself. At least I was. And then he tells her the story of how his young child died in the poorer parts of the Robot Kingdom from a lack of available medical care in like a truly, truly awful, awful way. And it's dark and intense. And clearly, Princess Robot has no idea that this amount of suffering is occurring in this kingdom. And just as Dango is getting to the part of the story where he tells her what his son's last words were, he just straight leaps across the room and stabs her in the face with the mop sword and says these awful words of, I forget what his last words were. And you're like, oh, this guy is fucked in the head.
Oh, my God.
Like, you're like, oh, he might... before this, I thought he was a little unhinged, but like clearly you're like, oh, no. He's like well past disgruntled, well past any other level. Like he is detached from reality, homicidal maniac. And then you get a sense as he scoops up Princeling Robot into his arms and walks back through the rest of the palace, just how violent and intense he is, because he's murdered all the guards very bloodily. And then we walk past the servants' quarters, where there's a nice sign on the outside that says, "Night staff, quiet please, watching our stories," which is amazing and a connection to the fact that they watch the open circuit.
Right.
Unfortunately, all of our servant class alligators have all been brutally slaughtered, and I don't see our main man, the alligator butler from the previous scenes, so hopefully he's okay. I was not able to identify any of these dead alligator serving staff as the alligator butler, but definitely Dango is willing to murder anyone who's getting in his way, and what he's decided he needs to do now is take some inspiration from the open circuit and get an audience for his message that he wants to convey.
Yeah. What a brutal couple of pages there. We've talked about how bloody and awful this story is, how real this comic is when it comes to showing violence. This is a stark example of that. This deranged robot who's clearly not okay in the head has clearly been through some trauma of his own that has turned him this way, just out here murdering people left and right in brutal fashion.
Well, there's like something sort of a little horror movie-esque to him, because all of these people he's murdering, some of them have guns, but he's able to just like take them all out with nothing but a mop sword.
Yeah.
So like there's sort of like a Freddy, Jason horror movie like superpower thing he's got going on, which it's like, I don't know why this janitor would be so good at sword combat, but clearly he is, and it's fucking terrifying.
Yeah. And that's actually reinforced when you actually flip the page to the next chapter, because the chapter cover is this horrific, like very horror movie poster shot of Dango not mopping up the floor, but spreading blood onto the floor. I love this cover so much.
Painting the floor with like, it's one of those times where they insert something very banal and like 20th century into this universe that they've created. It's just like, my mom had one of these mops. It's like a little sponge mop where you pull a handle and it like squeezes out the mop water. But in this case, it's not mop water that he's using to clean up something. It's blood that he's spreading around the floor with this terrifying skull face. It's scary.
It's scary. It's horrific. And that actually leads us right into chapter 21, where once again, we are back with Alana mid-scene at the open circuit. And she is facing a dilemma that will be familiar to anyone out there who has tried to make a living from art. How much selling out are you comfortable with? Clearly, Alana is not comfortable with what's happening on the circuit at the moment. She is clad in some type of very revealing lingerie.
Mm.
And these two female performers are just eating cereal. And this is SponCon for a presumably very sugary cereal called Cactos, which I actually kind of love the name of. I want to try Cactos.
I want cactus flavored like O's. That sounds delicious.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally working on me. I want it.
Mm. So Cactos aside, more important in this scene is that in order to get through the moral or artistic compromise of shilling for a sugar breakfast cereal, both of the performers apparently need to get high. So it starts with Alana's co-star, who says that she needs to get some fadeaway in order to get through this scene, which Alana is sort of blown away by, that she can perform while high. And her co-star is basically like, this isn't performing. We're promoting breakfast cereal. I can't get through this unless I'm high.
Right.
And then Yuma, always subtly, but still pushing, is like, hey, you want some? And Alana very smartly is like, this is the first scene of every boring cautionary tale ever, which is true. Mm-hmm. It's like an after school special. She takes the fadeaway anyway. And we get another example of where Hazel narration is used to bridge from scene to scene, where we get some narration that says, quote, "Mom never talked about this stage of her life much," over the scene of the open circuit. And then it cuts to Hazel in the backyard with more narration that says, she'd just say that kids don't need to know everything about their parents, but sooner or later, we all find out anyway. Which is both true and terrifying. And I think about it all the time of like, you know, you do so much to protect your kids from learning about the mistakes you make, but like, fuck, they're going to find it all out eventually.
Yeah, that's true. So you might as well just air your mistakes publicly on this podcast, Alan. Your children will find out anyway.
Might as well.
So this scene actually gets pretty uncomfortable. We've already talked about how pushy and flirty Ginny is with coming on to Marco. Here, it just gets to another level because, Alan, we get hand on thigh.
We get hand on thigh.
She reaches over, hand on Marco's thigh.
And it should be totally innocent, right? They're just, the scene is just Hazel playing with Ginny's daughter. They're in presumably the backyard of Ginny's home, which looks like a nice suburban house. They got a nice porch. They got a nice big backyard, big enough for Frendo to be like stomping around. And then they just like do what should be just like normal, you know, parent chatting. I've had conversations like this on the playground, but Ginny is pushing the like intimacy envelope. For sure, right? Like she's pushing, she wants to learn more. She keeps saying things like, oh, I don't want to pry, but then she does anyway.
Yeah.
And yeah, man, the last panel, the quote from Ginny is, a healthy marriage needs a few secrets, right? As she puts her hand on Marco's knee. And fortunately, that's interrupted by Hazel having some kind of accident, which it's not clear where the fluid comes from, but she's covered in some kind of yellow fluid that I guess. There was a scene earlier where Frendo, the giant walrus dinosaur, was having its period. So I'm guessing that that might be what this is, or it's pee. Whatever it is, Hazel is covered in it and kind of seems to think it's funny.
Yeah, I love that panel.
Ginny jumps up to go into mom mode and like get Hazel out of her dirty clothes. Marco freaks out because obviously if you take Hazel's shirt off, you'll see her wings. Things get real shitty. He's like, all right, we got to bail. But he doesn't totally bail because Ginny invites him to come to another class. And because Hazel's so into it, he agrees.
We then next jump to a Landfallian / Robot Kingdom ship out in space that is currently under assault. The team radios for help as shots are fired, as people are dying left and right. And we come to learn that this is a one-man assault. Dengo is John Wicking the heck out of this ship. It is incredible. We get this full-page shot of him, a rifle in one hand, grenade belt around his waist, and the head of one of the soldiers who he's holding by the spine, presumably having ripped the head and spine out of the body. It is an absolutely horrific panel. And I, as terrifying as Dengo is, I have to give props where props are due. This guy is taking over an entire Landfallian ship solo. That is incredible.
I absolutely love that I wrote Rambo style as my reference into the script, but you went John Wick, which is much better. And also shows, as always, the 10-year difference between our ages.
Yeah, true. I had to call that audible last minute. I've seen the Rambo movies, to be fair, but I felt like John Wick was more appropriate.
No, it is much more John Wick because it's all intense violence and like in close quarters. And somehow, once again, sort of superhero style, like he's going up against robots with full hand cannons and stuff. And he doesn't have a scratch on him while he's got a baby strapped to his chest.
It's absolute lunacy. And even his face is flashing to these horrific, like, clown and cartoon pictures.
Yeah, in that full page panel of him with like rifle in one hand, severed spine in the other, he's got like what I can only describe as something vaguely Muppet-esque on his screen face.
Yeah, terrifying indeed. This scene then ends with Dengo shooting one of the helpless soldiers in the face, who is praying in his final moments, and then commandeering the ship and directing it towards Gardenia. Mm. That's where our family is.
We all know how this story goes. Brian K. Vaughan brings all the threads together, and it tends to happen when people all show up on the same planet, which is classic sci-fi, classic Star Wars. Get everybody together. If they're on the same planet, they have to run into each other. So then we're back on the rocket ship tree, which is on Gardenia, and Alana comes home from work at the circuit bragging about how, because her performance is more natural, because she's stoned, she's gotten a raise. And she starts to try and talk to her mother-in-law and Isabel about it, and then she just, like, kind of mutters some nonsense sentence while her eyes are all bloodshot and unfocused, and you're like,
yeah.
Oh, she's high all the time now, and, like, clearly her mother-in-law and Isabel notice. But just when you think somebody might be, like, getting wise to her blossoming drug problem, she walks into her and Marco's bed chamber, cave, I don't know, something. And Marco's got the full-on, like, sexy time treatment going on. He's got magic candles going, and he comes up behind her just naked as a jaybird, presumably ready to go, and says to her, I need you right now. And then they proceed to have some sexy time while there's Hazel narration that goes over the top that is super interesting. There's a lot of this Hazel narration about like what parents share with their children once they become adults or before they're adults, where Hazel says, quote, long before I was old enough for the talk, mom told me about sex. She said she had lots of it in her life, but married sex was probably her favorite, which is wild and totally an inappropriate thing to talk to your child about. but as Alana and Marco start having sex in this scene, that's juxtaposed with the end of the narration that says, quote, some nights, even two old friends deciding to get as close as humanly possible could still be worlds apart, which is just like gutting.
Ugh.
And I don't know. It's intense. It's intense. Yeah.
It's intense. It's heartbreaking stuff. I mean, the words on the page could not be more tragic when we pair it with like what we're seeing on screen. We're going to talk a little bit more about this in our takeaway in just a minute. But yeah, this rift we're starting to see between Marco and Alana makes this sex scene, which should be, you know, a very intimate moment between two lovers, very much not that. Just a physical, animalistic moment rather than an expression of love between this couple.
Right. As much as they're physically connected, they're not emotionally or intellectually connected. In part because Alana is actually distant. She's high. She's like not being present to her husband. And it's not good. It's not good.
Yeah, it's not good. All right, so let's wrap up chapter 21. We have one more scene to go. Following the sex scene, we then cut to this idyllic scene of Prince Robot the Fourth and his wife and his slightly older son on a beach somewhere. And we quickly start to realize that this is a hallucination. This is not reality. We cut back to Prince Robot the Fourth, who turns out is still very much on sextillion and still very much just drowning himself in sex.
Mm-hmm.
It's at this moment that Mama's son decides enough is enough. She comes in and interrupts Prince Robot the Fourth to tell him that his wife has been killed. And this is obviously an absolutely tragic moment for him. This is terrible news for him to hear. But what really gets his attention, even beyond just learning that his wife has been murdered, is that he has a son. And this to me was personally shocking. Like the fact that this guy has been out here dealing with his pain, not knowing that his son was born, that's just, I mean, it's horrible. It's horrible. And obviously it shocks him to the core too.
Well, it also counteracts the beginning of these chapters when Mama's son was like, oh, he's hiding out here because his wife's had a baby and he's trying to avoid fatherhood. He didn't even know he was a father. So it's like clear what he's hiding from is actually different and probably is his wartime trauma. Or who knows, like, you know, maybe it's the damage that he suffered at the end of the last set of chapters because his screen's still cracked, right?
Yeah.
Regardless, he does not take well to Mama Sun telling him how long it's been since his child was born, which is 21 days.
Mm-hmm.
Mama Sun tells him that. He takes a beat to take that in. And then we get one of those amazing page turn reveals, which there's no coincidence to the way that Brian and Fiona sequence these pages. Whenever there's an amazing surprise that jumps out at you, it happens on a page turn. So in this one, you get a small panel of just Prince Robot the Fourth's face screen. And then you get this full page panel of him going full hand cannon and just like eviscerating Mama Sun through the chest with a close range hand cannon blast. And one of the tiny things that I love, one of the tiny little details, is that Mama Sun's like attendant servant, who's a little lizard, is so freaked out by this that his tail falls off, which is a thing that lizards actually have. When lizards, I had lizards as a kid, and when lizards get super freaked out, it's like the defense mechanism that they'll shed their tails and run away. It's meant to get the predator who was chasing them to go after the tail and leave them alone, and then they'll grow the tail back. But it's this just amazing little like thing of like this literally scares the tail off of her little like lizard friend that she's shot through the chest.
Yeah. Wow, I didn't notice that at all. I'm flipping to the page now and just now seeing that. What an amazing
detail.
It's
such a tiny little detail Easter egg that like these like little animal characters actually have the animal behaviors. It's amazing.
Well, chapter 21 ends with Prince Robot the Fourth deciding that it's finally time for him to leave Sextillion and that he needs to go talk to his dad. He'll know how to fix this, make everything right again, is what Prince Robot says. I have to go see King Robot. We end on a full page shot of Prince Robot's face. His TV screen shows an eyeball with a needle jammed right through the eye.
Jesus.
So we know exactly the kind of pain he's in right now. Just looking at that panel is tough for me. It's making my eyes water. And that's where chapter 21 ends. And today's reading ends as well. Brutal stuff. Tough set of chapters today.
Seriously, I'm going to need a break from all of that. I know I said these are my favorite chapters, but they are emotionally exhausting. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come right back, we'll have our takeaways from these chapters, as well as our favorite panels and quotes. So stick around.
All right, folks, welcome back. Let's get into our takeaways from today's reading. And then, of course, we'll end today's discussion on our favorite panels and favorite quotes. Alan, I wanted to start with this first takeaway because we just have to address the giant elephant in the room that keeps being foreshadowed in every single scene. Marco and Alana seem to be headed for a breakup.
Yeah.
Hazel's narration has told us as much. We see the rift forming between them. We see the stress that they are under individually and together as a couple. And it's sad. It's heartbreaking. This couple that we've been cheering for now for 3 volumes and 18 chapters are starting to drift apart. And it's horrifying to watch.
I will say that what has been explicitly foreshadowed is that they're going to split up, which we don't know if that means breakup or if they're going to be separated or something, but like something is coming and it's not going to be good.
Mm-hmm. It's not going to be good. And look, I mean, you and I know this, but relationships are tough.
Mm-hmm.
Even for like normal, seemingly happy, comfortable, easygoing people, relationships have their rough patches. There are ups and downs. And obviously, Marco and Alana don't fall into the category of normal, seemingly happy, comfortable, easygoing people. I mean, they literally have to overcome cultural, biological, and political hurdles that the rest of us cannot possibly imagine.
Mm.
Simply to continue existing as a family. The fact that the two of them have been on the run since the moment they fell in love is a huge factor. And then we also can't forget the fact that Hazel is a child that the two of them had together.
Mm.
And parenting is another layer that's added on to the stress of their already very stressful existence as a family. And, you know, at the end of the day, things like work, bills, parenting, they sound like very everyday problems. And Marco and Alana are also dealing with many of these things. But being hunted by two warring superpowers, that's kind of where they become a unique family and where their stress and their anxieties and the way they're coping at the moment goes in a direction that your average family doesn't.
See, I think it's interesting that they both don't start to look for outlets outside of their relationship until a lot of that like intense persecution and strain on their relationship has faded away.
Mm.
It's once they get into like the very banal day-to-day life of having a household and a family that they both start to crack a little bit, which made me think back to the difference between relationships I had in my late teens and early 20s as opposed to the marriage that I'm in now, where like, you know,
Yeah.
I used to revel in a little chaos, right? Like, you had, like, the chaotic part of your relationship, and you'd sometimes build a relationship around that. But then when it got time to, like, do the work of, like, maintaining a household, it can be challenging if you don't have, like, a firm foundation to build it on. And Alana and Marco clearly have this love, but it's one of the things I love about this story is that Brian K. Vaughan has created this realistic narrative where it's like a couple who has only ever found each other in trauma, chaos, and awfulness. When things get comfortable, they start to fall apart, which
yeah.
I think it's because they don't have that foundation, right? Like, they don't have that foundation of having done the day in, day out, like, who's going to buy the groceries and where, you know, is the cleaning going to happen and who's going to bring home the bacon, as it were. That's when, you know, they don't know how to do that yet because they've never had to do it before.
Right. Right. I love that. That's such a great point. And I think you're spot on, Alan. These two, from the moment they fell in love, have been on the run. The entire relationship has been built on this foundation, like you're saying, of survival, of being on the run, of being ideologically opposed to this war.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes time to just pay the repair witch for a missing part
mm-hmm.
in the rocket ship tree, suddenly they don't know what to do. Like, you're totally right. Once domestic life has hit
mm-hmm.
for Marco and Alana, things are suddenly way tougher because their foundation was built on something that wasn't domestic life.
And there is, I think you're right that there is also the baseline anxiety of the fact that, yes, they are still persecuted. Their fight that they have at the beginning of chapter 19 is entirely about the fact that Marco took
yeah.
Hazel out in public, and that scared the shit out of Alana because there is...
Mm-hmm.
So it's like the worst of both worlds. They're under this constant low level of stress and trauma, but they're also navigating unfamiliar waters of banal life. So it's like literally the worst of both worlds. It's not exciting anymore, but it is scary, and it's boring and mundane. Sounds like a recipe for, I don't know, something bad.
Yeah. Maybe a split, as Hazel has foreshadowed.
Yep.
I also wanted to quickly touch on how the two of them are coping
mm-hmm.
with the stress and anxiety of it all right now, because I think that's very revealing. It shows us their needs in a relationship. Alana, for example, obviously finds herself indulging in fadeaway, both to perform better at her job, but also to kind of forget about her problems a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I read that is that I get the sense that Alana is very much used to not being terrible at things she sets her mind to. Like, if she's going to set her mind to it, she's going to do well. And being an actor on the circuit is not quite the best fit for Alana, or at least she's struggling to fit in at the moment. And fadeaway is her easy button in this situation.
It lets her be comfortable.
Yes. And I think with the comfortability, there's another layer as well. She has this conversation with Yuma in today's chapters about, like, what the point of it all is. She's, like, questioning her job and the art of it all. She's wondering what the purpose of the circuit even is. And I think taking the fade away is also another way for her to stop overthinking. Mm-hmm. Alana, to me, feels very much like a classic overthinker and someone who can't just do a job for a paycheck, needs to find that purpose and satisfaction in what she's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the fadeaway, once again, is this crutch. It's a thing that lets her forget that and just literally fade away into nothing and do the job and get paid the bonus and bring that home to her family.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you look at Marco on the flip side of it, he is clearly someone who craves companionship. We've joked on this podcast before that Marco is a bit of a sensey boy. And he finds that, of course, in Ginny, in the mm-hmm. dance instructor. And I will say, this is very off-brand for Marco. I don't think Marco is the kind of guy with the type of personality that's prone to cheating. But it's obvious that his needs aren't being met by Alana. And that relationship with his wife is now being strained. And it's very human of us to seek out our needs where they present themselves. And Ginny just very conveniently has presented herself time and time again to Marco.
Mm-hmm.
That companionship, someone to talk to, someone to spend time with. Marco needs that more than Alana does. And so he finds it in Ginny. It's interesting how the way each of them cope with their problems reveals to us more about their characters as well. And also, just to wrap up, I briefly wanted to touch on the sex scene because I think it's one of the most tragic moments in Marco and Alana's relationship thus far. Alana, as you mentioned in the summary, is high during this. She's not even entirely present. And Marco is seemingly just fulfilling a physical urge, maybe even a physical urge that he wants to fulfill with Ginny and knows he shouldn't, and thus just like grabs Alana and says, hey, I need you. We're doing this right now. And I mentioned it earlier, but this very much feels like a purely like lizard brain animalistic moment. It's just two people being physical for the sake of releasing whatever pent up energy and frustration they're holding on to right now, rather than expressing their love and support for each other. There's no emotion here. It's all physical. And I just want to revisit Hazel's narration here very briefly, because I think the part that is the most tragic is the last couple of lines where she says, some nights, even two old friends deciding to get as close as humanly possible could still be worlds apart. And that's truly heartbreaking in the context of everything we've discussed in this takeaway about Marco and Alana's separation and the rifts forming between them and how they're coping with it. It's clear that this is just another way that they're both coping. It's not an act of love. It's an act of desperation.
Well, I think, yeah, it's really that act of desperation. I would take maybe a slightly different viewpoint. I don't know if it's a lizard brain moment as much as it's like Marco knows that things are fucked. And so he's trying to go back to the core of what he and Alana first, how they first connected, right? Like they had a very, very quick courtship, as it were. Like they went right from meeting each other to reading a romance novel to having a lot of sex. And so I think for him, it's like a return to try and like reestablish that connection they had at the beginning of the story, where they were having a lot of like very intimate, very like emotionally charged sex. But what they have instead is not emotionally charged sex. It's sex that's just sex. And I think that's the thing that happens in a lot of relationships, where you try to go back to what's worked before.
Right.
But if it doesn't address the broader issue, it's ultimately worse than if you'd not done anything at all. So it's, yeah, I agree with you though, that that's so tragic. And it's just like, especially when you think about it in the context of how much love was in the sex scenes in the beginning of this story. And this is just like, it's so,
yeah,
just even in the way that Fiona has drawn it, it feels almost like pornography, almost in a way that like the sex scenes previously never did. And I think that's intentional.
Totally. Totally. That's a great read on it.
Yeah. I can't wait to see. I mean, I both can't wait, but also am like super saddened to see where this goes.
For sure.
My takeaway is much, much, much less personal and much more academic, which is my takeaway is that I was struck in this chapter how, for the first time, we're really directly confronting class and economic station in the sagaverse in these chapters. Mm-hmm. Up until now, most of the exploration of the universe has been around like different races of people, their abilities, planet of origin, and like how all of those factor into drivers of this larger conflict. But it's becoming more and more clear through these chapters how stratified and just like unfair and unjust these societies are economically. Dengo is like the clearest exemplar of this, as well as like in that first section in the beginning of chapter 19 where they're explaining the robot kingdom, there's like an actual peasant toiling in a field. So it's like the robot kingdom is somewhere in between like Russia pre-revolution and like maybe going all the way back to like serfdom or something, but it's economically stratified, and very clearly the poor lower class black and white screen having working class robots. So it's a both an economic station as well as like physically they're less high quality displays. And then there's the upper class color display robots who are in the royal household, their aristocracy, they're like the military leadership. It's all of those like very classic like 17th and 18th century sort of upper classes. And they all live these lives of abundance and privilege. And what's interesting, though, is then that the class structure appears to be very different on each planet. Like on Gardenia, it seems pretty level, right? It's like your normal middle class society. There's like a nice middle class of performers and crew and staff on the open circuit. Ginny's got her little small business where she's teaching kids dance. Like all of these are very normal sort of like capitalist things that we'd be familiar with. And then even you have back on Landfall, when we got to see Alana's life of where she grew up, you know, that was a pretty typical, like, suburban upbringing, right? Like, her dad seemed to be very well off. And so, like, clearly there's economic diversity in this universe. But then I went down a whole rabbit hole where I was like, well, wait, so we talk about credits a lot, and unemployment is an issue, because Yuma comments on how lucky Alana is to have her job, or literally any job. So it's like, oh, well, so she's lucky to have a job, so unemployment must be an issue. And then this got me wondering even more, like, how do these economies actually work? Like, they talk about credit lines on Sextillion, so clearly they have, like, credit cards or something, and people talk about getting paid, but does each planet have their own currency, or is it, like, one currency for each side of the war, like the Landfall Alliance versus the Wreath Alliance? And also, I know I'm getting very much into, like, Star Wars Trade Federation boring territory.
Hell
here.
Yeah, no, do it. Episode one, baby.
But it does seem like there's a giant part of this war, much like in Star Wars, that is really an economic war, much more than, like, a war about, like, big causes or something like that. Like, Landfall and Wreath must have some kind of economic factors that are at play. And, like, all of them are tied up in this war, right? And quite literally, who is paying for all of this military hardware? There's, like, all this amazing military hardware on both sides, and who's paying for it, and where does it get built? All of these, I've clearly opened up a can of worms about the economics of this universe, but I just love how, like, there's these layers and layers and layers that are being added to the universe. And in this set of chapters, they've decided to introduce class. And as a result, like, rebellion, revolution, like, all of these themes that come into play. And it's part of why these chapters are among my favorite, I think. I love world building, and I love the additional layers of world that are getting put into this universe, that it's not just about, like, two sides opposed because they have different physical characteristics. Like, there's money changing hands here somewhere. And I think you get a lot of that from Agent Gale and whatever, like, shadiness he's got going on. But, like, I don't know. There's more here that meets the eye, and some people are getting rich, and some people are clearly very, very poor. If we've got, like, basically starvation level, you know, conditions for the working class on the robot planet.
Yeah. And you can even clearly see very much how shit rolls downhill when it comes to, like, where you are on the totem pole as well, because the princess yells at Alligator Nurse. And then just a few pages later, we see Alligator Nurse almost, like, take that out on Dango.
Right.
When she tells him to go clean up the shit in the room. And you can see how very much like the real world, these class systems and this disparity between the wealthy and powerful and the poor and downtrodden.
Right.
All falls on the people at the bottom.
Right.
Like, the princess may have, yes, gotten killed by Dango, but in a weird sort of way, it's because of the way she treated the alligator butler, and then the butler treated it. It's just like this domino effect falling down the class system. I did really like that sort of circular story that happened with the princess and the robot kingdom and Dango. And to your point, yeah, it showed us how not everyone in this story is rich and powerful, and not everyone comes from a similar background, and that the world building here is very true to life. There are people at the very top who are powerful and rich, and then there are people at the bottom, and there are lots of people in the middle on Gardenia.
I will say one thing that's very interesting to me that you just saying that made me think of is that we've seen the people at the top on the robot planet, but we have no idea who's at the top on either Landfall or Wreath, right?
Yeah.
Like, we hear about Wreath High Command, and we hear about, like, Landfall, but we've only really met Agent Gale, who is, like, part of this shadowy deep state thing, but, like, who's in charge on either of these planets? And, like, is anybody in charge? I don't know. I just immediately, I've literally never thought about this before, but, like, we're pretty far into the story for a war being fought. And it's like, who are the leaders that are prosecuting this war? We still don't know.
Right. We don't know. It's incredible stuff. And I love the drip feed of world building, right? Like, we could be just assaulted with world building like a lot of science fiction does.
Dune.
Just Dune. Thrown.
Like, Dune. Dune.
Dune. Exactly. The first, like, 50 pages of Dune is you need, like, a glossary to get through it. Like you have no idea what any of the terms are that people are saying. And Saga doesn't do that. It starts with a very human and relatable story and characters.
Right.
And the world is very slowly starting to expand. And I loved that you picked this as your takeaway today, because you're so right. We're getting another layer of this incredible universe that Brian and Fiona have created for us. We're starting to see the class system and the power systems within it.
Definitely.
And I can't wait for it to continue to open up more and for us to dive deeper into it and start asking even more questions about minutia that probably don't have answers, but will certainly have headcanon.
I absolutely love, though, that I was worried going too deep into this takeaway that you would not be here for it, but that when I make reference to episode one and the Trade Federation, I'm glad that you recognize the importance of that, and I am with
absolutely.
You. I actually think that that is an excellent part of it, episode one, but that's a totally different story. What we do need to move on to, though, is our favorite panels and quotes from this set of chapters.
Yes.
And for me, we talked about this a little bit already, but there's such an amazing panel, but also so hard to take in, is the last page of chapter 19, where Alana, Hazel, and Marco have that family hug, and Hazel calls it a skish, and there's just so much love and warmth and beauty, and just like Hazel's face is scrunched up in this little squeezy ball of joy. But for me, the first time it's so cute. And the first time I looked at this page, my eyes didn't even look at the writing at the top. I just focused on the family. And then when you scan up, you see the quote that says, like, this is the story of how my parents split up. And you're just like, you fucker. Fuck you, Brian. Like, I didn't want that. I had my heart was full of joy. And then you sucked it all out. And I was like, what do you mean split up? Their love is the center of this story. So you also get all of the little details in this page. You know, Marco's very like down to earth outfit is totally contrasted by Alana's like incredibly impractical out there circuit costume.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's intentional, is that like, you're like, okay, Marco is one in one world and Alana is totally in a different world. And the only thing keeping them together in this moment is Hazel stuck in the middle in this incredibly heartwarming way. So I love it. I love it so much. I could go on about it, but I feel like this episode is, we've been going a while. I will just one more thing throw out, though, that my runner-up for best panel is, as you already pointed out, the cover to chapter 21, that illustration of Dango pushing blood around on the floor with the mop is just, it just shows how dark and personally violent this story has become. Like, it was all about macro, big war, like mass scale violence up until this set of chapters. And now we're like very much in the micro, individual people, actual blood, like just so visceral.
Yeah, I love that. And I had a feeling you were going to pick that panel. I was going to pick it. And then I was like, nah, Alan's going
to
pick the
You don't have to give me all the kid stuff, man. Like, you can still think kids are cute, even though you don't have one yet.
Yeah. No. I also loved the squish panel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just this perfect combination, as we've discussed, of tragic and beautiful. But what I did end up going with, I decided that my other favorite panel, and this one was actually a pretty easy second pick, was that first time Alana takes the fade away and it really starts to hit and she starts tripping.
Mm-hmm.
And then you flip the page and it's this full page spread of Alana upside down, floating, sucking her thumb, eyes closed, completely curled up and relaxed. And these like bubbles around her spell out the words, fuck yes.
Wait, do they? The bubbles spell something?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, flip to that and look at it. They spell out fuck yes.
Oh, you're totally right. I have, again, read this now the fifth time, and I have never noticed that before. That's amazing.
It's amazing. It's incredible. And honestly, like, just as a standalone work of art, it's gorgeous. The colors, the composition, everything about it is absolutely gorgeous. And, you know, Fiona out here again, just hitting home runs page after page. I'd buy a print of this and put it up on my wall as art, in all honesty. In context, though, I also just love how fun of a representation it is of Alana's acid trip at the moment. Just seeing in the previous page those panels of how her reality is sort of shifting and then shattering around her. And then when you flip the page, you see just the utter bliss that she's in. She's very much in this childlike pose, right? Like when babies curl up and suck their thumbs, she's floating. All her troubles have gone away. All the weight of the universe that has been pushing her down and holding her back disappear in this moment. And I think this one panel and this one page says all of that in such a beautiful way. I also just want to say quickly that I also sucked my thumb when I was a kid, so I totally get it. It's a really soothing thing to do. And I don't blame Alana for, you know, going back into this moment in her acid trip. This is her happy place.
What I also hadn't noticed is that the fuck yes bubbles are also turning into stars. And then when you flip over to the next page, Hazel is dancing around with these little light up stars.
Oh my
gosh. So it actually connects the two scenes that like the bubbles are kind of floating off into these star shapes. And then Hazel as like the little dancing stars that are apparently teaching her how to dance in the dance studio, which is another amazing connection.
I hadn't noticed. Take note. Whatever animation studio Netflix hires for this adaptation. That would be a great transition.
Totally. Yeah, just the art continues to just like go to the next level with all of this. Very quickly, let's talk about our favorite lines from this.
Yes.
So for mine, it was not just one line. It was actually a whole exchange between Marco and Ginny where she's trying to get him to dance with her as that next scene and where they're alone in the dance studio as part of whatever the flirty seduction thing she's got going on or she's attempting. And she says, quote, "Well, you have to be brave before you can be good." And Marco responds, quote, "My father used to say that," which I was like, hold on a tick. So then I went back to chapter 11, where there's that flashback scene where Marco is trying to learn how to ride the grasshopper horse things with his dad. And the whole scene is all in blue. And Marco, when he falls off the grasshopper, says to his dad in blue, I'm not going to try and read the Esperanto, but he says, "I can't do this. I'm not good enough." And then Barr, his father, says to the child version of Marco, "You have to be brave before you can be good."
Wow.
And so it's like literally a callback. Like we'd actually had that line before in chapter 11 in the blue language. I do love what Brian K. Vaughan is doing with these lines because he's creating these little moments of coincidental intimacy and connection between Marco and Ginny, which are absolutely the way that things like this can just sort of happen, right?
Yeah.
Especially when Marco is not getting the emotional connection that he is used to or wants from Alana. And then there's just this random coincidence where this woman says the same thing that his father used to say to him, his dead father who's now passed away. And it's literally about being brave and like trying out something new and scary. Just amazing writing, amazing callback. I love it.
I love it. That's awesome. So my favorite quote from today's reading is actually from Hazel's narration at the start of chapter 19, where she's kind of giving us this exposition about the robot kingdom and its history. Mm-hmm. And then she starts catching us up to speed on what the family has been up to these past couple of months on Gardenia. And she says, quote, "We'd been safely ensconced here for several months. And you know what? Forget it. You'll catch up."
So good.
End quote. And that's where the narration cuts off. I love this kind of writing from Brian. He does it a lot in this story. Of course, Hazel has given us a little bit of exposition, and we're caught up just enough to start piecing together the clues ourselves. Mm-hmm. But I love that Brian trusts the reader to follow along, to connect the dots, to fill in the gaps where they need to, and doesn't feel the need to try and explain everything or to explain every moment. We are following the story of this family. We don't need to know about every single day that they've had together or every single moment that they've shared. We are seeing snapshots of the most important moments of their lives. And this, I think, is just very smart writing. This kind of writing, I think, just speaks to Brian's ability to tell this story in a way where we, the reader, are also a participant, but also speaks to his ability to build that tension. Right? Like he is a master of foreshadowing. He uses Hazel's narration to stress us the fuck out and wonder what's going to happen between Marco and Alana. What do you mean they're going to split up? We don't know. And he does a masterful job of filling in the gaps of what has happened thus far and hinting at what is to come and kind of keeping us on the edge of our seat.
And you never feel lost, right? Like a lot of times writers will try to do this. They'll try to skip around. I always love when I'm watching like a prestige TV show and I have to get three episodes in before I understand what the fuck is going on because they're trying too hard to make it like, you know, opaque and like figure out the story. But it's just like, no, Brian does this so masterfully that you never feel overwhelmed by exposition, but you also never feel lost.
Totally. Exactly. And also talking a bit more in universe, another layer to this narration that I loved a lot was that it really fits with Hazel's personality as the narrator of this story, at least from what we've seen thus far in 21 chapters, we've seen that Hazel has some of that like snarky attitude in previous narrations. And here it is again, her just kind of getting bored of the exposition and being like, ah, whatever, you'll catch up. I'm bored right. with telling you this story. And I like to at least personally imagine that that's a bit of her mother rubbing off on her, right? Yeah. We know Alana has that fiery personality and that feistiness is clearly showing up here in future Hazel, who is telling us this story as the narrator, in her personality. So sort of in universe, this type of writing fits so well with the character of Hazel that we come to know as well. So yep. ton of layers to it. I love it all around. Brian, you are a master, sir.
It's just so good. Okay, that was a lot. This all has been a lot. But lucky for all of you, for our next episode, we're going to do something different. We're going to have our first guest on the show, and we're not going to be going back to these older intense chapters. We're going to be talking about the new chapter of Saga that's coming out on April 27th, and that's chapter 58. And we're going to have a guest along to talk through it with us, another Super Saga fan. Abu, who's our guest? Who are we talking to?
Yeah, we're going to have our friend Patrick Austin on the show to geek out about Saga, to talk about that new chapter. So if you're all caught up with Saga and you plan on reading the new chapter this month, get excited, folks. It's going to be a good one.
And then following that, we'll have our, of course, next deep dive read-along episode to go over all of the even more intense shit that's gonna probably unfold in chapters 22, 23, and 24. So just make sure you're all caught up on those chapters before you come back for the next read-along episode, because I feel like shit's gonna get very, very real.
For sure. Well, friends, two minds can sometimes improve the odds of a podcast's survival, but there are no guarantees. So leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and be sure to check out the other shows on the Lore Party Podcast Network on loreparty.com. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, podcasts are fragile things, but just like Alana, Marco, and Hazel, we'll all just keep on exploring and learning together.